That's cool. What kind of microphone?
It's a Florion something or other. I guess.
Uh-huh. Isn't that a Pokemon?
You're thinking of Flareon, which I believe is also a kind of STD. Or no, that's just a symptom. Never mind.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. I am Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California, and with me today is my sometimes co-host, Keith Foster from San Diego, California, SoCal represent.
Hi, guys. What's up? Are you still mad at me about missing the Rogue One review?
No. No, I ended up being able to scratch together an episode. It worked out. I had Ashley on, Hitchcock, friend of the show.
I listened to it. It was good. I am a little bummed because I do have some opinions on that movie, but no one will ever know them.
Not that you want to air out here. Actually, please don't.
No. I'm telling you, it's you're gonna need Nicolas Cage to dig out these national treasures.
Actually, that does go, that segues really nicely, though, and I almost forgot, had you not mentioned that right now, that we got a letter.
Ooh.
From Patrick, frequent letter writer, Patrick, from Make Dad Read Comics. He had some opinions about our last episode, too, so I might as well just read that off now while I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
So I'm pulling that up as we speak. It says, great show, and get ready for rambling. I agree with both of you and guest host Ashley Hitchcock on the film in most general terms. I think he's talking about Rogue One.
Yeah.
I could care less about the leads in the film, Jones or Luna. They were the most flat, boring characters possible. They just say lines, pose, and everything around them moves. To be honest, why the hell did they even need Joan's character? Did she even move the plot along in any manner? And then it says, random stuff. Cassidy watched Night Of. He wants me to watch the show Night Of.
You should.
And thank goodness for Ashley not knowing what retcon is. I live in a bubble of nerd-related comic nonsense in which retcon is in every other comic-related article I read on Bleeding Cool or comic book resources. Although this is a concept that Dad on Make Dad Read Comics has been told over 24 times in the past year and still doesn't get, Ashley got in 2 sentences. Finally, did you see Ben Mendelsohn's claim on a different version of the film on Hollywood Reporter? I haven't read that yet. Because truth be told, this is the second time I've ever read this email.
Okay.
So I would have to, have you read this? It looks like some sort of theory, fan theory maybe, I don't know. Ben Mendelsohn says an enormously different version of the movie exists. Yeah.
You know what, I don't fucking care. Like, I'm getting so sick of, there was a different cut, bullshit, like, fuck you, just stop. Like, that's not what got released. I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck about your special hidden director's cut. I haven't given a fuck about a director's cut since Blade Runner. Sit on a dick, you dumb shits.
And you're speaking to Ben Mendelsohn and the people who want to see this cut, not our very nice friend of the show, Patrick, who wrote this
letter. Yes, yeah. It's just to movie makers in general, like, Suicide Squad, there's a better cut of it, we promise. Fuck you, that's not what I saw. There's a better cut of Batman v Superman. Fuck you, that's not what I saw. I don't give a shit about your special cut. Okay, I said all this, and I do want to add a caveat.
Okay.
unless the cut is just like a 2-hour version of that scene where Darth Vader is just like mowing down rebels at the end. That cut I would be interested in.
You know what? Okay, now we're talking about a movie that isn't what we're talking about today. Today we're going to be reviewing La La Land, and in our Netflix homework we'll be reviewing a Netflix homework assignment that your wife gave us, a movie called Colonia.
Yes.
But that scene in Rogue One with him like mowing down people in the hallway with the lightsaber, Darth Vader. To me, that was a lot like the cheesy scene in Episode 2 where Yoda goes like crazy ninja flipping around CGI weirdness.
Let's just move on to the news because this is going to end in an argument.
In general, I agree with you though about the whole thing about like these filmmakers and whatever who are in contention with their studio saying, like, I didn't get to make the movie I wanted to make. There is a little bit of, like, take some responsibility. But yeah, I find it interesting that these stories keep coming out because it kind of highlights what we've always known, which is that studios and the money, the big money suits in these corporations are very meddlesome and are really, really kind of standing in the way of, like, creativity.
But fuck you. Like, that's what you're signing up for. Mm-hmm. You got to make the movie you wanted to make when you made Monsters. You know, when you're signing up to make Godzilla and Star Wars, fuck yeah, the studio's going to get involved. I'm sick of your bitching. Like, maybe make some more movies before getting your giant studio franchise contract.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I agree with that, too. And I think that's by design. I think the reason why studios hire these like indie hit, you know, up and comers
is because they don't have the clout.
Yeah, to advocate for themselves when the studios say, actually, we've looked at the screenplay, we got to change this, 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 and this. You're going to be doing these reshoots at this time.
Yeah, they look for like, you know, directors and writers that had a hot premiere or maybe a hot follow-up, but don't have a whole lot of practical experience, and then, you know, they just kind of grind them up in the machine. Look at the whole Fantastic Four bullshit with the guy who did Chronicle.
Mm-hmm. Josh Trank, like, yeah.
I think that's sort of the most... I think that's just sort of sums up everything we're talking about.
Yes, totally. Yes, 100%. Okay, cool. Well, we've talked about things. what we haven't talked about is how is your Christmas? How was your vacation?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we went home for a little bit, just a couple days. It was a pretty short trip. Made it back before the insane snowstorm, mm-hmm. which sounds like, apparently it's like the worst snowstorm that Idaho's had since like the 80s or some shit.
That's what I'm hearing. I follow some of the, I still follow like KPVI and some of those Idaho's news things on my Facebook feed just to know things. And mm-hmm. they update whenever they have school closures.
Yeah.
And it's getting to the point where I'm like, are they going to start school again?
Yeah, this like, is like the fourth day in a row. It's like almost a week straight they've been off or something mm-hmm. crazy. I don't know. But you know, it's been kind of rainy here, so that's
it. It has been. I mean, it's been a very wet winter here in California, especially considering like how big of a drought we were in.
Yeah, which is good for California, but mm-hmm. I'm also like kind of sick of the rain, but you know, whatever. It's not bad enough to really complain about.
No, we should enjoy it while we can. Here in LA, it at least like cleans up the air a little bit.
Yeah.
So that's nice.
That's okay. Well, in San Diego, the air is already clean and it's perfect. So get out of here, rain.
Okay, let's go ahead and get into the movie news. And I didn't even know, but we have our fourth story from Patrick. So that was nice of him. but I'll start with this one.
All right.
Let's see. The Dune remake, the sci-fi film. Dune, which was originally directed by David Lynch in 83, I want to say, 83, 84, mm-hmm. Is set to be remade, and they're looking at Canadian director Denis Villeneuve, who did Prisoners and Sicario and Arrival this year, to direct. Now, I think this is a pretty cool thing. Of course, you know, almost as famous as Dune now is the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah.
Which came out a little bit ago.
I actually haven't seen it. I've been meaning to. I've heard it's good. Also, Dune is like a huge subplot of the show. What's that show on HBO? Togetherness? Togetherness?
Yeah, the one with the Duplass brothers?
Yeah, yeah. There's like that whole subplot with the live puppet show they want to do, the live Dune puppet adaptation. So Dune is like having a weird sort of renaissance.
It is. I think there's a little bit of interest in the property again. In part, I think sort of because of the cult of David Lynch sort of growing over time. Also, Jodorowsky's Dune, kind of the just sort of the weird curiosity of that sort of the movie that never got made sort of story.
Yeah.
And then I think on top of like, you know, we're just in a lot more sci-fi friendly, CGI friendly sort of environment, film wise. So there's some of the stuff I think they could tackle better now than they did then. And I think if you're going to get anybody to do it, Denis Villeneuve is very interesting. He's had like three, very good movies in a row. He's sort of on a hot streak. And this is a project to demolish a hot streak, but.
Exactly. Like, is this the exact thing we were just complaining about? Like, I think it's going to depend kind of on the studio and sort of what they're willing to give. Because are they trying to franchise Dune, or are we going to get to see like an artist's interpretation? Because isn't that kind of what happened with David Lynch's Dune?
David Lynch's Dune was produced by Dino De Laurentiis, who generally was well known for kind of making schlock.
Yeah.
Like, you know, kind of the 80s, like fantasy schlock and like, you know, kind of like, I don't know. He was involved with like Barbarella. Like that's kind of the world he comes from.
And gotcha.
For whatever reason in the 80s, he got involved with all these kind of weird art house directors briefly. So Dune was sort of a disaster. Famously, David Lynch was originally supposed to, was first approached by George Lucas to do Return of the Jedi. And he turned it down and did Dune instead.
Which don't get me wrong. I loves me some original Dune. I watched it for the first time a few years ago and I like really dug it.
It has a fan base. Yeah.
It's, I'm surprised how much I enjoyed that movie. Cause I thought I was just in for like a really long, boring slog fest. And it is longer and boringer than I don't know. I did expect more giant sandworms, but I was very much captivated by
you the loved plot all of that exposition about what the spice is and how the spice is from the earth and all of that stuff, all that voiceover that goes on endlessly.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, spice and weird nose tubes and fat suits and sting. Yeah. It's a crazy mess, but I also think that it is pretty ripe for plucking. Like, I think that they could do a very cool modern interpretation of it, and I do think that given Denis Villeneuve's,
he's French Canadian.
Given his track record, I've really enjoyed all the movies I've seen from him, so I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, and of course Villeneuve was also approached to do the Blade Runner reboot, so either way it looks like he's going to be moving up into a known franchise, and I think he could do just as good of a job in either. In fact, in some ways I kind of think Dune might be more appropriate, because I think that his style visually is more earthy.
Than
Cybertronic, but either or, I'm into it. Of course, a lot of his work has also been very noir influenced too, so that kind of works with Blade Runner. So I don't know.
So my big thing is stay out of the way, studios.
Yeah, I'm hoping that he has enough clout behind him and enough kind of, you know, if there's competition for his skills elsewhere, then I think he has a little bit more say in what the movie's going
to
be.
Yeah, he might have enough leverage to say, okay, fuck you, I'll just walk away.
Unlike Duncan Jones and the Warcraft movie.
Sure, I didn't see it.
Yeah, neither did I. Richard saw it. Okay, I'll let you talk about this Amy Schumer story. What's going on here?
So this is kind of an older story, but back in December, I saw me and my wife Ashley went and saw Amy Schumer live, and it was actually the day they announced that she is going to be playing the live action version of Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what to do with that information. I'm assuming it's going to be a comedy. I'm guessing it's going to be kind of a postmodern interpretation. My thought is sort of mm-hmm. like the 21 Jump Street version of Barbie.
Sure.
But I'm okay with that. I think it's actually pretty cool that they cast someone who is not what you would typically think of as a Barbie. Like, you know, she doesn't have the body type that was associated with Barbie for so long. So just in their casting, they're kind of making a statement. And I think it could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think, you know, Amy Schumer in certain contexts can be very funny. I think she can be kind of annoying as well. But I think this kind of context would work for her. And I think... Yeah. Taking sort of an ironic approach to the property is the way to go. It'll be interesting because, of course, the property is still owned by Mattel, and it's a very popular, iconic property. So I don't know if they'll be able to completely throw caution to the wind and do the Brady Bunch movie version of it. I think there has to be a certain amount of reverence to the brand that it can't. She can't talk about dicks and orgies and stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think you bringing up Brady Bunch is actually pretty apt. I think it'll be more along those lines than the 21 Jump Street model. I don't think it really can be R. And she's, she's sort of, she gets labeled as a sex comic. So that, that's kind of her reputation. So just in that pairing up is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm excited. I'm more excited about this than Baywatch, which looks all right. But Hollywood, you only have so many postmodern interpretations of ironic movie properties left.
Yeah, that's true. And I would be interested. This is one of those I want to see a trailer kind of movies.
Yeah.
I want to know what they're doing. I want to know what their approach is. It says here, according to Deadline, who reported the movie first, that Barbie, who begins to realize that she doesn't quite fit into her perfect plastic world after she's kicked out of Barbie land, she finds herself in the real world, and they're comparing it to Big, Enchanted, and Splash, are sort of their stylistic points of view. So I almost kind of sounds like Elf. Like, this is kind of Amy Schumer's Elf.
I could be into that, though. I mean, Elf is great. Elf is, it's a lot more funny than it needed to be. So I kind of hope that that's the case with this. I think they got a comedian with a really good pedigree to take the role. I just hope it's not like an origin story and it ends with her being played by some super skinny blonde girl.
That would be funny. You know what I think it's going to be is I bet there's going to be a lot of room here for Amy Schumer's kind of subversive feminist message, because I bet she's going to be this blonde ditzy Barbie girl, and then she's going to meet these real New York chicks or whatever who teach her what being a real woman is about in the modern day. I bet that'll probably be the angle, which could be cool too.
Yeah, no, I'm basically into this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Amy Schumer is the type of personality that she's not gonna put up with bullshit. If she doesn't genuinely like the script or believe in it, I really don't think she would be attached to it. Like, she doesn't need the money at this point. And this does seem like the kind of project that could really, you know, she could really say something with. So, yeah, say bring it on.
All right. And my last story here, very related to what we'll be talking about in our movie review. Ryan Gosling is set to work with Damien Chazelle again. Of course, they just did La La Land together. In First Man, A Life of Neil Armstrong, which is based on a book by Josh Singer, and it's a biopic about Neil Armstrong. Now, this seems like this is a little bit of kind of a weird move, I think, for Chazelle, who coming off of Whiplash and La La Land, which we'll get into it, but are two very different movies in some regards. This is even more so kind of a different take on an entirely different genre, which I like that I kind of like that this is his approach. Is he's just kind of like, he doesn't want to be known as the anything kind of guy. Like, Whiplash is sort of a psychological thriller. La La Land is a very, like, optimistic musical. And
we'll get into that.
And this is going to be a historical biopic. So, you know, I like that he doesn't want to get stuck in a genre.
My question is, will Neil Armstrong be listening to jazz on the moon?
I think Jazz on the Moon should be the name of your biopic.
All right.
And even though you've never played jazz, or, well, I guess you did play trumpet when you were like sixth
grade.
No,
doesn't count. It was junior high. Doesn't count. And I wasn't that good.
Do you have an opinion about this?
Not really. I like Damien Chazelle. Basically like Ryan Gosling usually. Yeah, I don't know. It kind of depend on the what they do for the biopic, because I think biopics can be pretty boring or they can be pretty interesting.
It's never exciting to hear about the news of a biopic, unless it's like a really left field kind of thing. Like, there was a story that came out a while ago about Josh Gad playing opposite Will Ferrell in a movie about Roger Ebert's time working with Russ Meyer on Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. That's a biopic I want to see. That sounds like nuts. But like, generally, like the Great Man biopics.
Yeah, I think if anyone could make a movie, a biopic interesting, it would be Damien Chazelle. Because I am a fan.
Well, good. You know what? I think let's just segue. Segue right over to the review, because I think that's where this is heading.
You really should get like a sound effect of a segue, whatever they sound like. That way, every time you mention it, we can like listener, imagine Cassidy and I riding on segues to the next corner of the room that says movie review in the corner.
Right. I thought you meant just like a cheesy sort of next up, like.
No, I meant like a literal segue, like a. I don't know what they sound like.
I don't either.
Vroom, vroom, vroom.
I don't think they even take gas. Okay, do you want to set up what happens in Damien Chazelle's second feature, La La Land?
La La Land, like you said, is a musical. It is very much a love story. It is a boy meets girl. I don't know what else to say besides it's a boy meets girl love story about a jazz pianist that falls for an aspiring actress.
In modern day LA.
Yeah, and that's the plot. Mm-hmm. It's like an old school romantic love musical.
Yeah. And I think the movie is, obviously we didn't talk about it, but the Golden Globes happened and it swept a lot of the major awards. And given that...
I'm calling it right now. This is going to be the white people movie that beats all the black people movies at the Oscars.
We'll see. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. We'll have to see how the Guild Awards play out before you can really make any kind of those sort of predictions. But, you know...
I'm calling it now.
All right. All right. I mean,
Okay. La La Land for Best Picture is kind of up in the air. I think it'll be tight between that and Moonlight.
Right.
But I guarantee you Damien Chazelle will win for Best Director.
Barry Jenkins, though. Okay, here's the
thing. Nope, I'll put money on it. I'm saying right now, Damien Chazelle will win Best Director.
All right, you're on the record. What happens at the Golden Globes? The Golden Globes are a ridiculous thing that happens every year because
yeah, I mean they're just like they're the party award.
Yeah, that's literally everyone goes and they get drunk and that. But what's interesting and why it's kind of hard to use it as a predictor anymore is because they have that ridiculous thing where they have the musical comedy award and then they have the drama award.
Yeah,
and of course. Moonlight won the drama award and or best original drama of 2016 and La La Land won for best musical or comedy, which it's kind of both. That's actually one of the few years where
it's actually been a musical and a comedy.
Yeah. Like it's not because usually that sounds like such a ridiculous thing. Like why would you put those necessarily together where you have like,
it wasn't the
Bridesmaids versus fucking Les Mis.
Yeah.
In the same category.
My favorite was The Martian, which was neither comedy nor musical, but was just like not a drama.
Yeah. So I guess what I wanted to kind of start out with this review is that what you said, there's, if you just look at the bare bolts of this movie, if you're just describing what happens in a synopsis sort of way where, Emma Stone's an aspiring actress and she's getting embarrassed, keep going to different auditions and being rejected, and Ryan Gosling wants to be a jazz pianist and start his own club, but his dreams keep kind of failing as well. So then, amongst trying to like rise in their personal careers, they sort of fall in love and inspire each other, but blah, 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 blah. None of that sounds particularly original. None of that sounds particularly interesting.
And well, I mean, even more so than not being original plot, like just even the structure of the movie is not original at all because it's completely paying homage to the old school, like romantic movies that are based solely on the chemistry of the two leads, a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers kind of thing.
Yes, very much so. Or Singing in the Rain and all of those musical romance movies from the 50s and 60s, especially the movies shot in like CinemaScope. So it's a different kind of framing than we usually see at a major picture if it's not done by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
I
have to tell you though, I loved this movie.
No, I did too.
I loved it. Like, I think it's a damn near perfect film.
Okay, I think it's, other than the story itself is not doing anything new, is not all that complicated, which it doesn't necessarily need to be. I think it does what it sets out to do pretty much with perfect precision.
Yeah, and even though it's not like a complex plot, I think that's definitely in the movie's favor because there's not really like plot holes. There's not much for you to pick apart because, like I said, it's just about watching these two people fall in love. And it's like, well, did they fall in love? Yes, that checks out. No plot hole there. Ding! as opposed to like this big, complicated, like sci-fi drama or whatever. Like,
it's not encumbered by plot. It's not a historical thing, so nobody can smear it with, "Well, this didn't actually happen this way." So as far as an Oscar sort of contender, I think some of the stuff that people are using against it is the simplicity, as well as the it's a movie about movies thing, and there's the whole thing about how Hollywood loves to award itself.
And they do. And I don't think that is going to change. I think that is going to work in La La Land's favor.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, of course, the year before last, the Best Picture winner was Birdman, which is also sort of a movie about the industry.
Mm-hmm. Which I liked Birdman, but that year, I think Whiplash was my favorite movie that year, too. I mean, Damien Chazelle is so goddamn good. And there's so much in this movie, but besides just, you know, the plot. Mm-hmm. Sure, let's get past plot. Like, let's not even worry about plot.
Yes.
Because let's worry about the characters and the relationships. And then on top of that, we'll layer on these gorgeous camera shots mm-hmm. of what could just be, you know, normal stuff that he makes look so goddamn pretty. And this weird transition from, you know, like early old school musical to modern movie, like it's so subtle. The about halfway through the movie changes and it's not really a musical anymore.
The musical numbers decrease, I think, as the drama ratchets up, but and then it sort of picks up again as we get into the third act. And I think that the musical numbers are placed here very, like I said, everything's done with precision. And you mm-hmm. can even see that if there is any kind of commonality between Whiplash and this, which I think are fairly different in style, mm-hmm. it's that precision and the subject
exactly.
of jazz.
Yeah, and but I mean, like, even down to the fucking color palette. Like, mm-hmm. at the very beginning, the first shot of the movie is this gorgeous tracking shot of this crazy musical number that breaks out on the freeway for no reason. Mm-hmm. Like, the height of musical fantasy escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is wearing these bold, you know, primary colors for costumes.
Right.
And slowly through the movie, the color palette slightly changes, slightly fades,
mm-hmm.
You know, as their relationship, as the drama ratchets up there. Like, sort of at the beginning of the movie, I was like, oh, man, is there going to be any conflict in this whatsoever? but then there is, and it's amazing and real and heartbreaking and... oh man, I just loved this movie.
Yeah, you know, I one of the things I thought about when I walked out of the movie, which I also liked a great deal, I was thinking the fact that it's a musical and it does require some amount of singing by our leads, and of course it's not live recorded like Les Mis. It is pre-recorded, so they're able to kind of play with the vocals or whatever. But Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are not two actors that are really well known for being singers and dancers.
I actually saw Emma Stone on Broadway doing Cabaret. So she's done musicals before. Her performance was specifically like a little more punk rock than that character is normally known to be. And I think part of that is that she doesn't have maybe the vocal range, but I think she's able to characterize her singing in a way that totally makes up for it.
And well, originally when I thought about this, I saw it as maybe a possible ding against the movie. I thought like, okay, well, why not have somebody like a Justin Timberlake and like a Lea Michele or somebody like those type of people mm-hmm. in the leads? And then I thought about what we gain in conjunction with what we don't get as far as musical theater perfection from the leads. I think what we gain from their chemistry. And also what we gain from them, knowing that they're already a kind of a screen couple at this point. They've been in two other movies as a couple.
Yeah. And they have amazing chemistry.
They have very good chemistry. And I think Hollywood's trying to set them up at this point.
Yeah, that's a little weird. Like, I don't need my actors to be really together. Like, stop it with your IRL. Fake Twilight romances, and and is that what was going on with Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield? I don't know. I don't want that.
I'm not necessarily concerned with that, but what I think that it highlights, the fact that they've been in two other movies as a couple before, Crazy Stupid Love and Gangster Squad, is that I think Damien Chazelle uses this movie, and I think there's a lot of what's going on in the subtext. There's a lot of really clever, ironic, postmodern meta stuff going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think there's a lot of little key things in the dialogue that if you're not paying attention, you'll miss, just as expository dialogue or just as kind of characters explaining how they're feeling or whatever. But I think it says everything about the overall statement of the movie. At one point, I was talking to a friend about this after I saw the movie, and I told her, every time that Ryan Gosling is waxing philosophical about jazz, he's actually talking about cinema. You can replace everything he's saying about jazz as what Damien Chazelle is saying about cinema.
Well, yeah, I mean, they even show that with the movie theater that's playing Rebel Without a Cause,
right?
And how it closes down, and yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
I also think Damien Chazelle loves jazz.
No, he's super into jazz. That's for sure.
And he makes me into jazz, and I'm not into jazz. Get this, Damien Chazelle. I am not into jazz. I'm Emma Stone at the beginning of the movie. But every time I see a Damien Chazelle movie, I'm like, yeah, jazz is like the fucking best.
And he makes it very exciting. He has a passion for it, which he's able to convey to an audience, which is not an easy thing to do.
No, and yeah, and he does it so well. If he can make me this excited about a dude on the moon, which I guess is actually a very exciting concept, but kind of boring in real life execution, at least to like the standard observer, that's not in the 60s. I'm down for whatever he's gonna do. Between this and Whiplash, I think both of them are damn near perfect films, and I would challenge someone to find a flaw in them, because
I agree.
I can't. J.K. Simmons.
His little bit in that is really good, and I think Damien Chazelle is almost kind of referencing his other character.
Absolutely,
I think he specifically he placed him in that part, not only because he knows him and he can get him in to do the movie, but also I think he knows what it's going to do for the audience. And I think this whole movie is so in conversation with the audience in ways that are very clever. I wrote down a couple of these quotes because I wanted to remember them. There's a point where Gosling's character is talking about how he's really upset about this Samba restaurant.
Samba and tapas.
Yeah. And he's talking about how they're, you know, anachronistic, and they're two different times. And he says something that, you know, they worship it, but they don't even understand it. And I told my friend in this Facebook conversation that every negative review of this movie is going to use that quote. because he pretty much handed it to critics to use against him. I think he's almost kind of criticizing his own sort of rhapsodizing of past cultures.
I haven't even really read any reviews of this, because
I don't until I do my own. But at another point, John Legend is talking about updating jazz, and he says, how can you revolutionize it if you're such a traditionalist, to Ryan Gosling? Because with Gosling, you know, he wants to kind of keep it the same. And in a way, it's like coming from this movie, which is obsessed with the past, which is obsessed with old Hollywood. And, you know, Damon Chazelle is a traditionalist at this point in his career.
Yeah.
And especially with this movie. And there's no way that this doesn't mean something. And, all of these kind of quotes are popping up. And finally, I kind of got it in my head. Oh, jazz means cinema. Okay, keep that in mind. And then at the end of the movie, there's a character that pops up. I'm not going to say how he relates to our characters, but there's a character that pops up in a bit part, that's significant to the movie, though.
I'm not sure
Oh, I'm about to tell you. He's played by Tom Everett Scott, who played the main character in That Thing You Do, who was also obsessed with jazz.
Oh, I do know who you're talking about. All right, all right. Yeah, yeah.
And he was a jazz drummer in that movie.
Oh, is that who that was? Holy shit. I knew he looked familiar, but I couldn't place it.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of puts a button on all of the movie's kind of self-referentiality. Now, some people could say that this is all very masturbatory and that this is all just kind of Chazelle sort of showing off what he can do. And I think that that's a valid argument if you're not into that kind of auteur cinema.
But here's the thing. No, it's not a valid argument, because if you can do it and you're like, why the fuck wouldn't you?
Well, and I don't think he does it.
Who are all these directors that have this amazing skill that aren't using it in their movies? No, go fuck yourself. Like, this is a really well-made movie.
No,
even if you're not into the story, even if you're not into the music, which I have two ears and a heart, so I'm into it.
Yes. The musical numbers are still very entertaining. I think what I would say to those people who would use that as an argument against the movie is I think that Chazelle never like goes down his own rabbit hole so much that it alienates an audience. It's never so navel gazing that it forgets to be entertaining. In fact, very much the opposite. It wants to be a crowd pleaser, an art film, and a traditional Hollywood big entertainment to do all at the same time. And this guy's almost our age.
Yeah. Oh, my God. You know, and the thing is, I think he's, at least from my perspective, while I was watching it, I would say he was completely successful in all of those aspects.
Yes.
The same with Whiplash. Mm-hmm. I was going into Whiplash, I remember kind of being like, okay, I like J.K. Simmons. I don't really know much about this movie. I just know it's supposed to be good. You know, I'm like, I guess it's about a band. Like, I was kind of strapping in for like a boring movie. Mm-hmm. And I was so entertained by it. I quoted and referenced Whiplash for years during improv scenes afterwards. To the point where the rest of the troupe had to be like, hey, could you stop referencing Whiplash?
A little less with the Whiplash.
And I didn't. because to me, it just like, it was so iconic in a way that movies just aren't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think a lot of movies are so forgettable. Like, you know, they have big characters or they have big plots or they have big whatever, but they don't have... There's not a lot of those like iconic movie moments that you can reference,
mm-hmm.
But his movies have them.
Yes.
And that's why you're able to parody them in the opening of the Golden Globes, Jimmy Fallon.
somebody has some Jimmy Fallon beef.
No, I don't. I didn't even watch the opening bit. I just, but that only works if there's, you know, an iconic scene for you to parody. And I think that's harder to do nowadays because they're so whatever else oriented that you don't get those quiet moments. You don't get those iconic scenes that could just be, I know
what you're trying to say. Yeah. You have to have it. You have to have something iconic enough for it to work as parody. And it works on that level this year. Here's my hesitation with calling La La Land the best film of the year, because it's in contention for that, even just for me.
Sure.
Which is also to, be reminded that this has been one of the worst years for movies in my lifetime. And I've also not been able to see as much as I would have liked to.
I will say there's a bunch of movies that I still haven't seen.
Right.
That are supposed to be really good, and I'm sure are very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just saying, I think the Oscars, they love love old school Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They love musicals. They love musicals. This movie is like begging for an Oscar.
Yes. And so here's the thing. So I'm still kind of putting together my list, and we'll be doing our official top tens next week. On the podcast, and I'll be writing one, here pretty soon for the paper. But the reason why I hesitate with La La Land, as much as I loved it in the theater, is mm-hmm. I remember how much I loved The Artist in the theater,
mm-hmm.
and how much I've watched it since it's been out, which is not really much at all ever.
Sure.
I have it on Blu-ray if I, you know, and it's in my film library if I ever need to pop it out and look at it again. But I've never, like, other than the theater experience, I don't know how much either movie, as great as they are and as smart as they are and as entertaining as they are, I don't know how much of a lasting power they have outside of the context of seeing it in the theater, because both movies are so referential about what they are, about being movies, and about the experience of cinema, mm-hmm. that I think it loses a lot outside of the theater experience, which I know that's unfair to say that, like, a movie needs to work, you know, on every single format ever, because I could also mm-hmm. say very much the same thing about Gravity. That's a movie I've never had any urge to see again out of theater, mm-hmm. as much as I think it's a feat of cinema while you're in a theater, and movies are made to be seen in theaters, even like, you know, traditional romantic comedies that don't have big musical numbers, are meant to be seen in theaters. But I don't know what the lasting power of this movie is. This is one of those ones where I kind of need like 3 years away from it to really be able to see, like, what is the legacy of this movie? Is this,
I mean, yes and no. I get what you're saying, but I
don't have answers for these questions. That's why I say hesitant. I'm not saying it's a dig against the movie. The movie is what it is, and I think it works really well if you're into this type of experience. If you don't like musicals at all, if you really hate positivity and chipperness, if you don't like lessons to be learned, if you don't like broad melodrama, there's a lot of stuff in here that's not going to work for you. And I don't think that a person who doesn't like those things generally mm-hmm. should be told to fuck off just because the movie didn't work for them personally. I
agree with that. But at the same time, like, when you're comparing a movie, when you're saying a movie is the best picture of the year,
mm-hmm.
you're comparing it to all the other movies in that year.
Yes.
So lasting legacy kind of doesn't matter when it comes to that, ranking. Like, when you're comparing it to all the other great movies ever made, yeah, that's when it gets a little more heady. Now, for me to say this is undeniably the best picture of the year, I can't say that because there's a lot that I haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
But
you liked it a great deal.
I liked it a great deal. And I think Oscar voters are going to go that way, because that's traditionally speaking, this will be the movie that wins the best picture. If you base it on what typically wins at the Oscars.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily concerned with that. That's fun to think about and to place bets on and that kind of stuff. I'm thinking about it more as like, am I in love with this movie, or am I just drunk by the movie experience?
Well, here's the thing. I don't care. Because when I saw the movie in theaters, I was completely in love with it. Mm-hmm. It totally worked. And so I got that movie going experience that was required. Mm-hmm. If I don't watch it again in 5 years because it doesn't hold up on DVD, fuck it. I got that experience. And that's more than I get out of a lot of movies nowadays. Mm-hmm. So I say it doesn't matter. Like, sure, I might not watch this movie as much as I'm going to watch Captain America Civil War, which, whatever, but I got thrills. I got chills. I wanted to, I laughed. I wanted to cry. Like, I got the cheesy poster tagline movie experience. And to me, that's worth more. Like, that's what we're going to movies for. So, and the same with The Artist. You know, like, I haven't seen it since, but my experience when I saw it was exactly what was expected of me. And so I think it, that's what matters to me is the movie going experience. I mean, yeah, I hope those movies will have rewatch value and stuff, but that's just like the cherry on the cake.
No, yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, I think one thing that this movie has going for it, as far as legacy, if you're concerned about that at all, which you don't necessarily have to be, but I think about those things. But I think the thing that has going for it is that Damien Chazelle is so far a force to be reckoned with. And he is so young that he has a long career ahead of him. And seeing how, you know, his next project and his other works beyond that go, this could be, you know, part of an overall auteur body of work, an oeuvre, if you will. And if that's the case, then it doesn't matter how popular the movie was or wasn't this year, or what awards it did or didn't get. You know, we'll be talking it in conjunction with his work. And that's a more interesting conversation to me than, you know, what won what award.
I agree 100%. I mean, how many times do we talk about, like, these amazing movies that were like, oh, that didn't even win the best picture that year. And we're like, you know, what? How is that possible? You know, like a Pulp Fiction or whatever.
Yeah,
no, I agree with you there. The awards don't really matter. I'm just calling it now that Damien Chazelle will win Best Director.
All right.
And yeah, and you know what? At the end of the day, no matter what, it has a kick-ass soundtrack. Just like Whiplash. Like,
have you been firing that up in your car?
I not in my car, but on Spotify on my computer when I'm like cleaning my office or whatever. I was listening to it last night as I was writing jokes, actually. So yeah, I listened to the soundtrack. I've listened to the Whiplash soundtrack a lot more than I've seen the Whiplash movie.
That is interesting. The last thing I want to say about this before we move on. Other than to say everybody should go see this, I think this is it's a no-brainer. It's a fun movie-going experience. If you don't like fun, don't go. But I greatly enjoyed it. But I'm also a movie geek. The other last thing I wanted to say is there was a movie that came out earlier last year starring Anna Kendrick called The Last 5 Years, which was based on an off-Broadway musical.
Yeah.
Very similar.
I actually didn't know they made that into a movie. I've seen the stage show, and yeah, the stage show the last 5 years messes with time more. Like this is very much a straightforward chronology. Whereas that's part of what's going on with the last 5 years is the way the story unfolds.
But the story, I mean, and like the way the characters play out, and like, you mean, I think in the last 5 years, the guy's a writer and she's like an aspiring Broadway actress because it's in New York. But other than that, there's a lot of weird similarities, and nobody saw The Last 5 Years, which I think was a pretty good little movie too. I think this movie's better and is much more, a lot more cinematic verve going on here than in that movie, which was made on a much smaller budget. But if people like La La Land, go back and look at Last 5 Years, because I thought it was pretty good.
Sure. Again, I haven't seen the movie. I actually do kind of want to see it. But as far as like any similarities, I don't think that's, I mean, even Last 5 Years is also just sort of an archetypal breakup story. So,
right.
You know, we were just talking about how sort of broad the story is. And I think that is to relate to the most audience possible. So I think, you know, the fact that they're musical breakup stories, to me, that's about all. But I do get the similarity. I think it's worth
noting. I think it's worth noting because they came out so close together. And musicals in general are not like a big genre anymore. So whenever mm-hmm. one happens, it's kind of a big deal. I think people will look at the last 5 years, like if we're talking legacies and decades from now, if either movie's talked about at all. I think people will look at last 5 years as the Phantom of the Paradise to La La Land's Rocky Horror.
Sure. I guess I get that. I actually, I am very curious to see that movie because, like I said, I've seen a stage production of the last 5 years and it's a really cool script. So, yeah, I'm sure that's worth checking out.
Let's move into the Netflix homework now, which is there's a lot going on in this movie and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, unfortunately. But it's called The Colony and or Colonia. I think it was retitled at some point. It's,
yeah.
Directed by Florian Gallenberger, who I've never heard of before. He's a German filmmaker.
I guess so.
But this is a English language film for the most part. It's a historical piece, mm-hmm. sort of a thriller of sorts or psychological drama about a young couple played by Emma Watson and Daniel Brühl. They come from Germany and they're staying in Chile. Brühl is sort of a revolutionary and he's working with the Chilean revolution as Pinochet takes over. He ends up being captured by the Chilean police and sent to live in this weird colony or compound out in the middle of nowhere that's headed by a religious cult leader. And to find him, Emma Watson decides to infiltrate as a student or
a recruit
of this compound, and ends and they both of them kind of get sucked up into this world of psychological and physical abuse and torture that goes on for something like 100+ days. Mm-hmm.
A Nazi cult, by the way. It's not just a religious cult. It is literally Nazis.
Yes. I believe I read about that. Like, I didn't remember this until almost the end of the movie.
Or as we're calling them now, the alt-right.
I've been calling them the alt-reich online.
Ah, that's cute.
And I liked it. but I remember reading about the story a long time ago, like back when we lived together a long time ago.
Okay.
And I didn't remember reading about it until around the middle to the end of the movie. And it's like, oh, wait, I do know about this guy. I think it was either something as almost as weird as Maxim or Cracked wrote an article about they were calling this guy the most evil person who ever lived.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not all. Okay. So in the movie, they show, you know, how he abuses people physically, mentally, emotionally. He sort of rules this camp with an iron fist.
Yeah.
But they sort of imply that he molested children, but they don't really explicitly show that. But in the real world story, he was found guilty of something like 300 child rapes or something, like, mm-hmm. insane. Yeah, no, he's pretty much the worst human being that ever lived.
And he's played by Michael Nyquist, who I think most people will recognize as from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He played the villain in Mission Impossible, one of those Mission Impossible movies, one of the later ones. I think Ghost Protocol. So he usually kind of plays sort of weird bad guys. And there's a certain, I'll say this about the movie. The movie has kind of a big melodrama to it. Mm-hmm. That it is so dark and it is so fucked up. And the fact that it was based on a true story makes it even more heart-wrenching. But
yeah.
The amount of melodrama, and maybe it's just sort of my brain sort of trying to disconnect it from the reality of the situation that did happen.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of slips into Flowers in the Attic camp every once in a while.
Okay.
And not necessarily in a bad way. As big and overstated as this movie is sometimes, mm-hmm. I think that I was totally sucked in. And
yeah,
I had no
yeah.
idea what this movie was. I knew Emma Watson was in it. Like,
no, yeah, my wife. She just recommended it because she watched it because of her love for Emma Watson.
Sure.
And she watched it and was like, holy shit, like, what the fuck? And it, and she didn't know it was based on a true story going into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end, when it like revealed the statistics and facts and stuff, you know, how movies are wont to do.
A postscript, yeah.
Yeah. She was, it like blew her mind. And that was why she wanted us to watch it. And I honestly, my guess is they probably had to tone some of the stuff down.
Oh, yeah. You can definitely tell they do in a lot of ways. I mean, the movies, you know, in its depictions, it's rough stuff, no matter what, you know, mm-hmm. especially some of the torture scenes with Daniel Brühl when they're like electrocuting him and stuff.
Well, yeah. And
they kind of go for it there.
Yeah. And I want to know sort of in the real story, because in the movie, he fakes being mentally handicapped, due to how much they've tortured him.
And that was one of those things too. Like that might have actually happened, and there's only so many ways you can portray that, but there was a point when like that's going on, and then you have these long speeches by Michael Nimquist, who is eating this up.
Oh yeah.
Like
yeah,
it's
but
a
I mean,
big performance.
But that's what you need to take on a, you know, a character like that, is you need someone who can sort of embody this
pure
just
evil.
Like
yeah
just
but
the, like
he's
the
really,
moment
I mean,
he walks on the screen, you're just like, oh, he's gross, and you don't even know why.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, I don't like you.
Yes, very much so. And I think overall on a movie level, all of that stuff works. I'm entertained, I'm sucked in. You know, and I was not expecting to be like by the middle of the movie, I was like, this is working. Like, this is like a weird kind of way to say this, but kind of a fun ride. Because there's an escape.
I think you're the only critic who ever said this is a fun ride in regards to this movie.
Prison escape movies and that kind of stuff. There's a certain amount of thrill and like the plans to get out and that kind of
stuff.
There's a lot of like thriller kind of stuff in here. It's like, are they gonna like leave this bit of evidence that gets them caught or da 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 da. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of genre stuff kind of working here. And I think, you know, if I were to criticize the movie as a whole, it's that the fact that it is a real event that actually happened, and there's a certain amount of sensationalization.
Sure.
Sensationalizing of these events that kind of favors genre in a way that makes it more fun to watch, but not necessarily in a way that's really reverent of the fact that this is a real thing that actually happened to real people.
Unpack that a little bit. What do you mean?
So like I said, there's a lot of genre stuff here as far as like these thriller moments of when will they not get caught.
A particularly exciting airport
third act
scene.
Yes.
Yeah,
which reminded me like straight out of Argo.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of these moments that you know are movie moments. They may have not occurred exactly that way. They may have, who knows. But there's a lot of this performance by Michael Nimquist, who's like, he's like Faye Dunaway in Mommy Dearest and meets Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. Okay.
It's this meets maybe a little bit of There Will Be Blood. Like, it's this really big scene chewing performance that you know he's, as an actor, kind of reveling in.
Oh, yeah.
And I think as a genre piece, I was really sucked in and I was really involved with the story and I wanted the characters to be able to escape and all of that stuff. But I think as a historical piece, I have a hard time knowing,
like, what really happened.
What really happened here, and how much of this is being sensationalized? There's a little bit of it, like, of kind of like the. Did you ever see a movie? An old 70s film. That's completely ridiculous, and also has to do with Nazis, but it's also a great time, and I completely recommend it. Called Boys from Brazil.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Fans of that movie, there's kind of a weird sci-fi angle on that movie that sort of comes up out of nowhere, but makes the movie a million times better.
Okay.
I get shades of that kind of.
So you're saying like if there was a moment where Michael Nyquist was like, introducing his werewolf women of the SS, you wouldn't have been totally surprised.
I would have been like, oh, okay, never mind. This wasn't based on a true story. They used some sort of factual thing to invent this sort of thing.
Well, I think that's why it was, you know, probably so shocking to Ashley when she got to the end of it and it was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
But I do agree with you that you don't really get a sense of what really happened. Mm. Because I definitely had to like look into some of it afterwards, but it definitely piqued my interest. Mm-hmm. So I think it was effective in that regards, like making me want to know more about the real story.
Yes.
Which, as far as like historical drama, I think that's probably the best you could sort of ask for. So I guess that doesn't totally matter to me, because it was a lot more entertaining and just generally better than I sort of expected the movie
to be. And more affecting than I thought it was going to be. I kind of thought it was going to be boring, to be totally honest, especially when
I did too.
From the first act when I'm like, oh, it's about a political revolution in Chile in the 60s. Like, I just don't know.
Yeah, and I remember I watched the trailer for it and I was like, okay. And I thought, based on the trailer, that it was going to be a very different movie. I thought it was going to be kind of the opposite. Like, she gets indoctrinated in this cult and he has to go save her. I didn't know it was like they both don't want to be in that situation kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was going to be a very different movie based on the trailer than it was. And I was pleasantly surprised. I think
I was too.
The trailer didn't really do it any favors.
I will say, I'm not so sure about Emma Watson in this movie.
Yeah.
She's doesn't ruin it. She's as good as she needs to be, but I kind of feel like she's a little hermetically sealed from this environment. And maybe that's a little bit of why the movie sort of registers a lot more campy than it should. As I kind of feel like she's sort of being protected. There's a few scenes in the movie where she's nude, but she can never really be nude.
I kind of get what you're talking about, just because I always sort of felt like she was going to be okay. I was more worried about Daniel Brühl's character.
Yeah, I think he completely throws himself into this. I mean, in more ways than one.
And maybe it's just because maybe it's part of the plot. Like I will say this. I think it is kind of cool that she goes into the camp to save him.
Yeah.
From a feminist perspective. And I think you do have to be aware of that with Emma Watson cast as an actor.
I was definitely aware of that. As the movie was unfolding, I was like, oh, I can see exactly why she was handed this screenplay.
Yeah. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think, you know, casting her to play a strong, independent feminist, you know, woman who's going to go and save her boyfriend. I think, you know, that was a smart casting decision to pick someone who's so outspoken about their political ideals and casting them. But I do think that might be kind of what was separating you from from her performance in particular, is her character is written a little differently than the sort of camp that you felt like was there. Like, you know, typical movie, her character probably would have been a lot more exploited. And because she wasn't, might have registered some of that disconnect, whether or not.
Maybe. You know. I mean, I think there's a little bit of, I think she's in this movie and with this director, she reaches the ceiling of her abilities pretty early on. Okay. In the movie, and there's some hefty dramatic stuff that I feel like she isn't quite up to in this movie. And maybe there's a little bit of kind of Harry Potter, like, hangover stuff in my brain still, where I'm just like, you're Hermione Granger, I just don't know about all this.
Hermione Granger would have been out of that camp in a second.
Well, yeah.
She would have just, you know, used some magic to stop the Nazis.
I feel like maybe like somebody like a, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an actress, like maybe like a Juno Temple or somebody who I know is willing to get into the mud a little bit more.
I don't know. I think I kind of agree to disagree with you on this one.
Okay.
Because I mean, I did totally get what you're talking about her feeling a little disconnected from the situation and a little safe. Mm-hmm. But I felt like more was at stake with Daniel Brühl's character, and I definitely felt like they had enough chemistry and enough connection that I genuinely cared about their relationship. So
yeah,
I think to me that was more the threat. And so I think that she was actually a pretty good choice for the part as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm. I would recommend this movie. I think especially as a Netflix grab bag, this was a big surprise. I was totally invested. I think it's big and pulpy, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Yeah, it's got enough fucked up stuff for you to go, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it keeps your attention and wakes you up every now and then.
I will say there was kind of a stretch in like the second act where I felt like it was getting a little dragged out. I thought the third act was very exciting, but there was some kind of slow stuff in the middle that, you know, maybe we could have used a little more exceptionalism. I don't know, maybe not. Mm-hmm. You got to pace these things.
And the next time we end up doing a Netflix homework, next week we're going to be doing our top and bottom five or tens, depending on the direction of the episode. But the next time we do a Netflix homework, I'm going to have us watch Richard Iotti's The Double, which came out a couple years ago, starring Jesse Eisenberg.
All right. Sounds good.
And that's it. Where should people go online to see the content that you do?
Actually, I have a lot coming up. I have a lot of not online stuff, but you can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter. I'm on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. You can find me on Facebook probably. I do have some shows coming up too. I think this episode should come out in time, but, you can catch me at the Comedy Palace on Friday. I'm doing the 7:30 and 9:30 show there. Tonight in San Diego comes back January 30th. Our premiere is going to be at the Music Box in San Diego. So we're doing kind of a big, fun premiere. So we're not at our normal theater. We'll be at the Music Box. So it's going to be a really big show, a lot of fun. So make sure you check that out. I will be at the Comedy Palace next Thursday as well on January 19th. I will be performing improv with my San Diego improv troupe TCP West at Old Town Improv Company on January 26th. I should be posting all of this to Facebook soon as well. So if you don't want to keep rewinding and replaying this section of the podcast for all those dates, look for me online and you can find me.
Cool. So you're a busy guy. You'll be doing a lot of things in January.
Yeah.
You can find the podcast at on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can follow me at BC Cassidy. You can also email the show as Patrick did at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com if you have anything or any grievances with any opinions that we shared here today or in past episodes.
Tell us what you thought about Star Wars Rogue One, a Star Wars story review.
All right.
We're going to stretch the Rogue One Star Wars story review out for like 6 months until people finally know how I felt about it.
I finally posted my actual written review. Even though I wrote the review weeks ago, I finally posted it online. Mm-hmm. And I always post it to the Reddit r movie critic just to get some extra eyeballs on it. And I also put in whatever conjoining podcast goes along with it to hopefully draw an audience there. And I kind of, you know, I always put little headlines or like kind of whatever to grab eyeballs and get clicks on Reddit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was late at night or whatever. I was feeling a little poetic. I kind of got a little flowery with it. A little flowery. Okay. with my thing. And I got this like really mean message at like 1:30 in the morning before I went to bed. It was like, that headline made me want to vomit. It's like you used a thesaurus to look up the smartest sounding words ever.
Oh my God.
Okay.
What was the headline?
Oh, do you really want to know?
Yeah. Well, at this point in the story,
I kind of built it up, haven't I?
Yeah.
Rogue One chooses plot over story, losing a quirky ensemble in the murk of its own melancholy.
Okay. You know what? To the Reddit user who felt like he had to look up those words in a thesaurus, maybe get the thesaurus out a little more often. Like, come on, dude. Those aren't that bad.
So it was a little flowery or whatever. And I was thinking, like, you know, it was late at night. And I was like, okay, so not a lot of people have seen it. If I don't want to get downvoted to death here, maybe I'll just delete it and put something a little simpler. And then, like, a few seconds later, somebody right underneath him was all like, I don't know, I think murk of its own melancholy is a pretty rad phrasing.
And maybe you should change the name of this podcast to murk of the its melancholy. Own melancholy.
That would be like the name of my biography.
Oh, great. Way to end on a down note.
So anyway, yeah. I got
to listen to that movie podcast where the guy's probably going to kill himself. Yeah, I'm just counting down the episodes.
I think that's every movie podcast. You can also find us on Stitcher and Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. And you can read some of the content that I provided for the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin, at MacGuff.in/author/Cassidy. I had to send them a preliminary top 10 so that they could do their aggregated top 10. That it will not be the same top 10 that'll end up being my official top 10 that I do for the podcast, because I've seen a few things since then. You can also check out my reviews that I post weekly, like the ones I just talked about, at southforkreviews.blogspot.com. And be sure to listen to our friends out there who make podcasts as well, Patrick at Almost Educational and Make Dad Read Comics, and Rod and Denise at their music request podcast, The Listening Party, and Denise, who is, I think, about 6 episodes deep into her mascot podcast, Mascot Diaries. And she,
I remember you telling
stickers.
Me about that.
Yeah, I got stickers in the mail from her.
Oh, cool.
And they're really cool. So people should go to that. It's a really cute, light podcast. She interviews mascots from all over the place, you know, at different levels. Like, some are like high school mascots, some are like college, some are like for AAA division teams. Some will reveal their identity, some will not.
Oh, that's great.
So it's an interesting half-hour little podcast she releases every once in a while.
Since we're in the wrap-ups, sure. I do want to say, since the next one we're going to do is our top 10 list, mm-hmm. Based on the stuff I've said on this podcast, if anyone can figure out 5 of my top 10, I will give them a special shout out on the show. So write up what you think 5 of my top 10 will be. Email it to Cassidy, or Twitter it, or whatever it. And if you're right, I will give you a shout out. If you are wrong, I will give you a shun.
All right. That's fun. It's like a game.
Yeah, a game.
We'll see if anyone participates.
No one will, but that's okay.
We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.